accession number 18802, reel 9.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 9. You were saying that you had overseas students from India and Pakistan, and you mentioned Denmark.
Yes. India, Pakistan, Denmark, Yugoslavia, South Africa, Rhodesia, Ceylon, I think, as it then was, Jordan, Israel. In fact, the recent Prime Minister who was assassinated was in my year at Camberley.
Rabin?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about him in particular?
No, I remember him being a very serious-minded student. Well, that's 9, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm sure there were some others, and I just can't remember off the top of my head. Well, an American, of course, and a Canadian. Yes, I'm sure there were about 12 in the division.
What about the directing staff? Were they all British, or did you have overseas officers?
Mainly British, but each division had an American. Wait a minute, have I got that right? No, I think there was an American for the Staff College as a whole. There was a Frenchman for the Staff College as a whole. There was a Canadian for the Staff College as a whole. And I think that's probably about it. I think that's right.
On balance, was most of your time spent in syndicate, or was it out on the ground in the open doing practical things?
Mainly in syndicate, is my recollection. Now, what the actual balance was, I don't know. I mean, on one occasion, it went out for the whole day. But it was mainly in syndicate.
Do you remember going off and doing the battlefield tour?
Yes, I do. But I remember battlefield tour much more from when I went back to being a DS there. But am I right? Perhaps we didn't have a battlefield tour in my student year. Do you know, I can't remember. I think we must have done. But I certainly remember going on one when I was DS. And, of course, we did joint service visits. I mean, I can remember going to the RAF down the road here at Little Rissington, which was then called the Central Flying School. And I can remember being... We were taken up in a jet, and we were taken up in a piston aircraft. I don't know if you want to hear all this, but the piston aircraft was a... I forget now. It made a hell of a noise. That's all I remember about it. The jet was a Meteor, and the pilot who was assigned to take me up, young man, and he said, "Oh, what do you want to see?" And so I said, unwisely said, "Oh, I'm told these things take off quite well." And his eyes lit up, and he said, "Do you really want to see that?" And I said, "Yes, please." And we took off, I don't know, at 180 knots or some incredible speed. We went from 0 to 23,000 feet in, I don't know, 5 or 6 seconds or something. It was incredible and very exciting. And so we did various things. And, you know, occasionally I found the earth up there and the sky down there and so on. Exhilarating. And he was a very, very good pilot and a very nice young man. He finished up as... captain of the Queen's Flight eventually, and then died very young, which was very sad. But at the end of it all, I think probably I was ashen-faced when I got out of this thing. I think we were up for 10 or 15 minutes, no more. And he said, "You know, did you enjoy that?" And I said, "Yes, I did. It was absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. But I'm extremely glad I'm an infantryman." And, you know, we parted friends. So there was that visit. We went to the RAF Staff College, if I remember correctly, for some exercise or other, or discussion or other. We went down coal mine, We went to one or two of the research establishments, etc.
Did you have a lot of written work to do during this course?
A certain amount of short written work, yes. I mean, an exercise, you know, write the minutes of a meeting, write a paper about something or other, quite short. And one major thing, one historical exercise, which was a long essay, which I'm afraid most of us put off till the bitter end, and then scrambled to produce our 30,000 words or whatever it was, some incredible number of words, which I don't think any of us really gave much attention to, which is probably very naughty, but there we are.
Do you remember what you wrote about?
It was some historical thing, and I absolutely can't remember what the subject was now.
Did you have to do presentations as part of your training, Staff College?
I don't remember doing that as a student. I certainly remember doing it as DS a lot. And, of course, in my later life as a staff officer, I did quite a lot of presentations and enjoyed doing it. I don't remember doing it as a student.
Of the things you learned at the Staff College, what do you think was most valuable? What new skills did you acquire that were really useful?
I'm not sure they were new skills exactly. I mean, obviously technical stuff on the staff side, which I hadn't done before. But I think in many ways it was honing one's own sort of latent skills and personality and so on the one hand. Insistence on degrees of excellence on the other hand. And of course, getting on with people of all sorts of kinds, which is perhaps the most important thing of all. And I suppose ambition came into it in a slight way, but in the nicest possible sense, not what I call naked ambition. I think most of us who were there learnt to be ambitious and want to get on. But in a civilized manner, rather than an investment house manner.
How were you assessed?
Well, all I know is we were assessed each term by each individual DS, and I suppose we're put in some sort of order of batting and graded. And there was a G1 who was a full colonel for each division. And he tended to sort of see you after each term and say, either you're bloody sure, or you're all right, or you're doing very well, or you'll just carry on as you are, or something like that. I don't think one really knew how one was doing until the last term when jobs came round.
How long were the terms?
They varied a little bit. I suppose the first term was probably 8 weeks, if
this
I remember
staff
correctly.
Staff duties, wasn't it?
Sorry?
This was staff duties.
Largely staff duties and simple stuff, the basics of.
You'd really done some of that already, hadn't you, when you were in Cairo?
Yes, I had, but this was much more formal and much more insistence on detail, insistence on getting the words right, insistence on getting the order of words right, and the full stop in the right place. You know, all the basic things that you try and teach people so that it becomes second nature.
Service writing.
Service writing, yes, mm. Exactly mm. That. But I think the last term was a short one, if I remember, probably about 5 or 6 weeks. And the other terms sort of spaced themselves out in the middle, depending on. I mean, there was a telephone battle term, more or less, and there was a tute term. I mean, things got spread out during the year anyway. But I don't think there was an average length of term. They were all slightly different.
Did you have leave between the terms? Or did they run one into another?
I don't remember some of these things. There was certainly summer leave, that's for sure. I think there may have been, I don't know, 48 hours between terms, but by and large they ran into each other, if I remember correctly.
So the time came round to the last term, and this was the term when you got notification of your next posting.
Yes.
When did that happen? Was it just before the end, or did you have a reasonable amount of notice?
I think it was about 2 weeks before the end, from memory. The result of which, of course, was one or two people were terribly despondent, and one or two other people were sort of thrilled to bits.
Well, how about you? Were you happy with your...
Well, I was lucky. I got one of the best jobs going.
Yes.
A super job. Mm. And people were very envious.
So then your next move was in 1954, GSO2, Military Operations 4 at the War Office.
Yes.
Yes. Did that entail going up to Whitehall every day?
Yes. The O War Office, as it then was.
Yes.
In the O War Office building, yes. Yes.
And that's just around the corner from Scotland Yard, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So what were the main duties of GSO2, Military Operations 4, War Office, Middle East?
Well, it was split into two bits. It was MO4A and MO4B, and I was 4B.
Yeah.
And 4A, in very broad terms, was west of the Suez Canal.
Right.
4B was east of the Suez Canal. And so my parish, let's call it, was Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi.
Did it go as far as Iraq?
Yes, I visited Iraq. And indeed, I suppose in that year, the most interesting period was one of the joys of the job was I talk about the parish in inverted commas.
Yes.
But, you know, one was responsible for strategy, for chiefs of staff briefing, all that sort of thing. Liaison with the Foreign Office to an extent, but to a very limited extent. And one of the perks of the job was you got one trip during your tour. And your tour normally, of course, was 2 years, and mine was only one, as it turned out.
Yeah.
But I did a roughly a month's trip. I started off at GHQ Middle East, went to Jordan, on to Iraq, and then down to the Persian Gulf with the Trush Lehman Scouts, and it was the most wonderful trip. GHQ Middle East, I was just really being briefed on what I should and shouldn't do. Jordan, I fetched up I was looked after by nothing to do with Brits. I mean, it was all with the local forces.
Yes.
And I was looked after by a gent called Fawaz Maha, who'd been a student at Camberley when I was there. And he was commanding a battalion at that time on the West Bank. And he eventually fetched up as a divisional commander. I don't know what happened to him after that. And he was a Circassian... No, I've got to get this right. I think he was a Circassian... I was going to say Christian, but maybe that's a contradiction in terms. But he was... a very broadly educated and a very nice man who took a great, great interest in the political scene in that very troubled country. And he took pride in trying to be impartial. And I'm talking, of course, now of the Arab Legion, as it then was, before it became the Jordan Army.
Hmm.
And I spent a day with him driving more or less the length of the front, as it were, and it was very interesting. I mean, what he said in detail, I couldn't begin to remember.
Mm.
But listening to it all and trying to assess, you know, where the various things fitted in, I just found a very interesting and rewarding experience.
So you were going along that UN-supervised ceasefire line between Israel and... Jordan, along the West Bank. So this would be what, on the edge of the Judean Hills?
Well, do you know, the awful thing is I can't remember exactly what route we went, but
yes.
We went in broad terms from Aqaba to Marn,
yes,
and then on to Amman.
Mm.
what our actual route was, I'm sorry, I couldn't begin to tell you.
And what kind of battalion did he have? Were these his men, were they a Bedouin battalion, or were they Palestinian?
I never saw his battalion.
You didn't see his battalion?
No, I just saw him. I mean, he was assigned to take me round. I mean, I'd seen James Lunt, who was commanding one of the armoured regiments at that time, because I happened to know him.
Were they based at Amman at that time, or in were they down at Aqaba?
No, they were. They weren't at Aqaba. I think they were outside Amman somewhere.
Did they have... were they armed with tanks or armoured cars?
I think, if I remember correctly, there was an armoured car regiment and there was a tank regiment, I think. Certainly there was an armoured car regiment.
Do you recall if they were at a place called Zirka?
Yes, I think they probably were. Zirka I remember from a little bit later on, in my going back to my UK hat in MO4, because Zirka was a great discussion about, if I remember correctly, stationing an armoured brigade there.
Yes.
British armoured brigade.
Yes. So we had, effectively, we had two armoured regiments out in Jordan at the time. And what was the sort of atmosphere like? Did you get any sense of the atmosphere in the place, the political atmosphere in
No,
Jordan?
I didn't, I'm afraid. I didn't go to any on the civilian side at all. I was I really just spent a day going up and down with this fellow, and a bit of a day in the Arab Legion headquarters.
Yes.
But I didn't really get involved with the Jordanian people at all.
Who looked after you in Arab Legion headquarters? And did you meet Glob?
Yes. But not for long. It was quite interesting because Jennifer had a great uncle called Peek Pasha, who had, whether he was the first head of the Arab Legion, I can't remember. He was certainly one of the very early ones.
I think he went across the Jordan into Transjordan in...
He was Transjordan Frontier Force.
Around 1921, he was Transjordan Scouts and Transjordan Frontier Force.
He was indeed. Yes. But I think then became the Arab Legion.
Yes, they were the cadre for it.
And I can't remember when he left, but he was certainly... so the family, I mean, I haven't studied his history yet, I hope to one day. But Uncle Fred, he was, Peek Pasha. And I think I'm right in saying that he was around at the time of the assassination of the king, was he?
Abdullah,
I think he was. And I think in many ways was regarded for the future king, who Hussein as he now is, I think was regarded as sort of guardian for him in this country. I think, but I may have got that slightly wrong.
What was the reason for us having the two armoured regiments in Jordan, as far as you knew at the time?
I wasn't visiting our armoured regiments at all. I was visiting the Arab, the Arab Legion. Well, of course, at that particular time, we rather prided ourselves on having a force in the Middle East, did we not? And indeed, I can remember when this... actually, I think it was the next year, after I'd left MO4, that this idea for the armoured brigade came up.
Yes.
And it was all to do with the threat from the north and from the east. And John Harding, who was in the CIGS, I remember he produced a piece of paper, this proposition for the brigade on it. And a civil servant, who should remain nameless, wrote on it, "This is a load of rubbish," or something like that, which always struck me as quite odd for the head of the professional head of the army's opinion being challenged in that particular way.
Of course, this is 2 years or so. You were there, if you were there in 1954, it was 2 years after we'd agreed to leave the Canal Zone, isn't it?
But you see, there was something called the Baghdad Pact.
Yes.
Now, I can remember a telegram from Baghdad, Foreign Office telegram, I can't remember. I used to remember its number, but I've forgotten that. And I do remember, this is after I'd left MO4, when I was the vice chief, and I was obviously responsible for sifting his telegrams when they came in. And I remember reading this one and thinking, well, this is hot, this is something big, this is really going to go big, and rushed it into him and so on. But if you ask me to remember the justification for doing these various things, I absolutely can't, I'm afraid. I mean, you know, it's just gone.
So you were in Jordan for a few days.
Yes.
And you were sort of looking around the country. Were you looking at anything specific from a strategic or operational point of view?
No, absolutely not at all. I was mainly just to say hello to the Arab Legion and then move on to Iraq.
Yes. Where did you go in Iraq?
Well, I ought to have done some homework on this. It was up in the mountains, and I absolutely can't remember all the. I went to Kirkuk, I remember, and if you shouted out one or two names, I would probably say yes or no.
There's Arbil, Mosul.
Mosul, certainly. But I went, again, not for strategic reasons at all, but to say hello to the Iraq army. And I was looked after by, I forget the name of the character, who sort of looked after me for two or three days. Very friendly. They seemed to be on our side at the time, but it wasn't too long after that, of course, that the chief of staff was dragged through the street behind a jeep or whatever he was dragged behind, not to mention the prime minister as well. And that must have been within 2 years of that, I suppose.
There was a coup in 1958.
58, was it?
Yes. That was the coup when General Qasim and Colonel Arif took power and murdered the royal family and the government.
Yes.
I was going to ask if you detected any signs of anything bubbling up, you know, while you were there.
No, because again, you see, one really didn't travel outside the cantonment in which the Iraqi army I was with lived.
What did you make of the Iraqi army? Did you see anything of their
units?
Not a lot.
As I said, I mean, they seemed to be, as far as I could make out, pro-British. They seemed to be interested in what the Brits had to say. But I didn't go on any manoeuvres or anything like that, so I have absolutely no idea, really.
Did you go, did you visit the embassy in Baghdad?
No, I didn't, but the AMA, both in Baghdad and in Jordan, had sort of said hello. In Jordan, in fact, I stayed in his house, which had been Pete Pasha's house once upon a time. The AMA in Baghdad, if I remember correctly, came with me when I went to the Iraq army. And then, having spent a few days with them, I trotted off down to the Persian Gulf. To Sharjah, I think, is where we stopped. And I finished up in Bahrain with a splendid man called Brigadier Baird, who I think had been with Arab forces for 32 years or something like that. And indeed, the next year, when I was with the vice chief and he was visiting, and Dixie Redman, who I was with, said, you know this fellow, will you sort of be nice to him and so on? So I said, yes. And when he arrived, all he really wanted to do was to go and buy a suit in, I don't know, Austin Reed or somewhere. And when we went to his club, he was so far distant from the UK, he said, oh, you know, do I tip people or don't I tip people in his club? And sadly, he died not all that long afterwards. But it was my first introduction, really, to people who had devoted their lives to living in the Arab world.
He'd gone native.
He'd gone completely native.
Mm.
Completely native. But I think my main recollection of that particular part of the trip, and I suppose I must have been around for about nearly 10 days probably down there, was at Sharjah, which is the headquarters of the Trucial Airmen Scouts. The thing I recollect most was some little boys, I suppose they were in their low teens, doing signals. They didn't speak a word of English, but they were highly expert at trotting out the Morse code. Mm. And there they were, diggling away on their buzzers, corresponding with whoever they were corresponding with, but they were being taught the basics of the rudimentary army signals. They made a big impression that these little youngsters, not speaking a word of English, were able to do this really for their army and their country. Why it made a big impression, I don't know, but it did. And the other thing made a big impression on that particular trip was I went to an oasis called Buremi, which is also called Elayne, I think.
This is a disputed oasis, isn't it?
That's right. And indeed, it was being invested at that time by the Saudis.
Yes.
And I think there was a possibility of flying there. And I think, in fact, I flew back. But I was also told that one could drive there in a Land Rover across the Sand Sea. And I thought that would be something I'd never do in my life again. And so I better try and drive across the Sand Sea. And so they said, well, you've got to get up frightfully early in the morning before it all gets too hot, otherwise you'll get stuck forever. And I think we left at 4 a.m. or something like that. And it was a most extraordinary experience driving across the Sand Sea. But eventually we fetched up at, we got stuck on a number of occasions. But we got through eventually. Now I'm told that the road is an 8-line metal highway. An 8-lane, I mean, metal highway down to Buremi, I'm told. But Sheikh Zayed, who is now the ruler of the whole of the United Arab Emirates, he at the time was the son of the then ruler of Abu Dhabi, I suppose. And he owned the fort in which the Trucial Airmen Scout Squadron was located. And there was a British major there who spoke fluent Arabic. And I met Sheikh Zayed very briefly. I was taken to say hello to him. And I can remember this imposing presence and piercing eyes. That's what I really remember about him. And, you know, one got a feeling of here is a man of certainly authority on the one hand and possibly honor on the other hand. And I can remember him, funnily enough, Jennifer and I most unusually went to Ascot a couple of years later. And I remember sort of seeing their flag flying, and I thought, oh, you know, is he here? And there he was, you know, one saw him in the royal enclosure at Ascot. Mm. And I only mention that because before I came back, I was, you know, I said I'd obviously be calling at the Foreign Office on my return. Could I do anything for anybody? And they said, yes, for God's sake, try and get some sort of gong or honour or something for Sheikh Zayed, because, you know, he's produced this fortress free of charge, no rent, no etc., etc. He does a wonderful job for us all, etc., etc. And so they said, you know, he ought to have a K, really. And so I steamed off back to what I think was, I think it was called the... I went to the Levant department to about some of the business. I think this was called Eastern Persian. I forget what it was called. Anyway, I steamed along there and said my piece and said, you know, they're all terribly pro Sheikh Zayed, and they think he ought to have a K, etc. And what did they say? I got some very deadpan answer saying, you know, if he was lucky, he'd get something or other. But it didn't sound like an honour. I can't, absolutely can't remember what they did say, but absolutely deadpan. But, you know, he became a familiar, much more familiar figure in years to come and quite soon afterwards. And I felt privileged to have met him. You wouldn't know me from Adam, no, but...
What did you think of the Truchelmon scouts? Did you see them doing anything?
I didn't see them actually operating, because having arrived at this fort, I was really confined there. They wouldn't let me go out and round and about, I think probably rightly, because if I'd been captured by the Saudis, it would have been a very tiresome incident for all concerned.
Were they deployed to defend the oasis?